Thank you, Fenway, for reading that. I think that was his first time that he's read up here. I'm not sure about that, but that was a long one. And I asked him, I said, do you want me to give you something short? He said, no, I got this. So he did really good. I appreciate that. And Nancy, I appreciate you putting the passage in the bulletin and just handling the bulletin week in, week out. We're blessed by so many people willing to do so much work for us. I will admit I'm a little more nervous today than usual. I think you all know that daylight savings time ended yesterday, which means everybody knows I had an extra hour to prepare for this. So expectations might be a touch higher. I don't know. But anyway, I've wasted most of that extra hour resetting all our clocks, so I don't really think I gained much. But when I was a kid, probably, I don't remember exactly, I'm guessing 6th or 7th grade, somewhere in there, my grandpa introduced me to a book called All Creatures Great and Small. And it was a book written by a guy that went by the pen name James Herriot. He was a veterinarian in the Yorkshire Dales up in England. And he wrote actually a series of books that talked about his life, his professional life as a vet in that area, starting in the 1930s. Mostly talked about the people and their interactions and obviously about the animals. But it also included little snippets about the Dales, about that area of England. It talked about rolling hills, these bright green pastures, old stone walls, rock buildings, tiny little villages on windy roads. And one of the impacts that those books had on me was I had a strong desire to go to the Yorkshire Dales. I wanted to see what that place looked like and experience what that was like. And I've been fortunate. I've been able to do that. But many of you might have some similar desire to go to some certain place. Maybe a book that you read, maybe a TV show you've seen, a movie, maybe just somebody telling you about their amazing trip to some place or whatever. It has sparked an interest in you to want to go to a particular place. Well, this morning I want to talk about a place that hopefully all of us want to go to, heaven. We have a book, the Bible, that tells us about a lot of stuff, and scattered through the Bible, we have these little snippets, these little descriptions of what heaven is like. It's really kind of amazing when you think about it, how little of the Bible actually talks directly about heaven. There's just not a whole lot that's there. But I want to take a look at those passages this morning, and I'm hoping to do three things. I want to, number one, remind us that heaven is a definite place where God and the angels and Jesus and other people dwell. I want us to look at those passages and just remind us of the descriptions that we have of heaven, because we oftentimes look at so many other things in this book. And lastly, I want to hopefully just encourage everyone to do what they can to get to heaven. So, first of all, heaven is a definite place. And the passage that Fenway read is one of, I think, the longest description we have, and I will reference several parts of that. I will not reread it to you. But the Bible has a lot of things that show us that heaven is a definite place. In fact, Jesus himself says in John 13, starting in verse 33, John 13, 33 through 36, he says, "Little children, I shall be with you a little while longer. You will seek me, and as I said to the Jews, where I am going, you cannot come. So now I say to you, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this, all will know that you are my disciples if you love for one another." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, where are you going?" Jesus answered him, "Where I am going, you cannot follow me now, but you shall follow me afterwards." So heaven is a definite place. It is a place where Jesus could go, would go, and it's a place where his disciples, including us, could and would follow him. So it's a definite place. So where is this place, heaven? Well, as we look in the Bible, it's overwhelmingly described using kind of a vertical imagery. It's up, it's higher, it's above us. We see this over and over again. Heaven is a place from which God looks down from. Okay, that's mentioned in Psalms 14 and 2, Psalms 102:19, Psalms 80:14. Psalms 80:14 says, "Return, we beseech you, O God of hosts, look down from heaven and see and visit this vine. So it's a place that God looks down from. Heaven is a place from which Jesus came down from. John chapter 6 has several verses that mention this. John 6, 33, 38, 41, 42. All mention Jesus coming down from there. John 6, 38 says, "For I have come down from heaven, not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me." Heaven is a place that people on earth look up to. Deuteronomy 30, 12, 2 Kings 2, 1, Acts 1, 11, Luke 18, 13, all mention this. Luke 18, 13 says, "And the tax collector standing afar off would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God be merciful to me, a sinner." In Acts chapter 1, we see that heaven is a place that Jesus ascends back to after his resurrection. It's in Acts 1 and 2, and then Acts 1, 9 and 10. Acts 1 and 2 says, "Until the day which he was taken up." So going up. So we have God looking down from heaven. We have Jesus coming down from heaven. We have Jesus returning up to heaven. We have man looking up to heaven. The point of all this vertical imagery is obvious. Heaven is remote from earth. It is separate from earth. It is higher than earth. It's a superior place. It's completely different from what we have here on earth. Heaven is clearly separated from earth. Now, sometimes we use the phrase, "This is heaven on earth." We'll see some great sunset or beautiful scene, or we'll go through an area that's just amazing. No one's ever said that about Kansas, by the way. But people will say something like, "Oh, this is heaven on earth." And I don't think it's wrong to say that, but there is a definite separation. Ecclesiastes 5:2 clearly states, quote, "God is in heaven and you are on earth." There is a separation there. And again, it's the superiority of heaven. Now, not only is heaven a place and a superior place, but it is the place that God dwells in. It is the place of God. It is the home of God. If you look for the phrase, the exact phrase, "God of heaven," you'll find 23 separate passages in the Bible that say "God of heaven." I'll read two of them to you. Psalms 136, 26 says, "Oh, give thanks to the God of heaven, for his mercy endures forever." And 2 Chronicles 36, 23, "Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth the Lord God of heaven has given me, and he has commanded me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah," and he goes on from there. So heaven is the dwelling place from God. God is of heaven. Heaven is referred to as the holy and glorious habitation of God. That's in Deuteronomy 26, 15, as well as in Isaiah 63, 15. Isaiah 63, 15 says, "Look down from heaven and see from your habitation, holy and glorious. Where are your zeal and your strength, the yearning of your heart and your mercies towards me?" In two other passages we have that are fairly lengthy dealing with heaven, Isaiah chapter 6, Ezekiel chapter 1, we have visions of heaven. We'll talk more about these visions in a little bit. But in both of these, what we see is dominated by God. If you were to take the time and read through Isaiah 6 and Ezekiel 1, you would see that a big part of what's being described there is this presence of God. Isaiah 6, 1 says, "The train of his robe," speaking of God, "filled the temple, took up the whole space," God's presence. Ezekiel 1, 26 through 28 describes a figure seated on a throne with the light radiating all around him, filling the entire space. We have several other examples in the Bible that show us very clearly that heaven is the dwelling place of God. Jacob had the dream in Genesis 28, one of the classes that the kids learn about from a very young age. Genesis 28, 11 through 16, Jacob has this vision of a ladder. He sees angels going up and down the ladder. And what does he see above the ladder? He sees God standing above that ladder. God is there in heaven. Stephen, just before being stoned to death by the angry mob in Acts chapter 7, looks up to heaven and sees God and Jesus standing there. So we have numerous passages that show us very clearly that God dwells in heaven. But as I said, he's not the only one there. I just mentioned Jesus again in Acts chapter 7, verses 55, 56. Jesus is there with him as well. We also are told in numerous places that angels are in heaven. Again, Jacob in his vision in Genesis 28 saw angels going up and down that ladder, going back and forth between heaven and the earth. There's about a dozen passages, if we go through and look, that tell us that angels are living in heaven. Again, I'll give you a couple. Matthew 22:30 says, "For in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels of God in heaven." And Mark 13:32 says, "But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father." So angels are in heaven with God, and heaven is the dwelling place of the redeemed. It is ultimately the home for people who are obedient to God. Matthew 5:12, Luke 6:23 both say, "Great is your reward in heaven." That is the final place where you get to go if you're obedient to God. We see Elijah taken up to heaven in a whirlwind in 2 Kings 2. He gets to go straight, doesn't go through death. He gets sent directly to heaven as his reward. John 14, 2 and 3, Jesus talks very clearly about heaven as a place where we get to go. John 14, 2, Jesus says, "In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may also be." All right, so we saw Jesus go back to heaven in Acts 1, and he's saying, you'll get to come join me if you obey. In the reading that Fenway read earlier, Revelations 21:24, it said, "And the nations of those who are saved shall walk in its light," that light being the glory of God. So we see very clearly here, heaven is a definite place. It is a place where God dwells. It is a place where the redeemed live. And it's a place, actually, that at times seemed fairly crowded. Revelation 5:11 says, "I look, and I heard the voice of many angels around the throne, the living creatures, the elders. The number of them was 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands." So there's a lot of people, a lot of beings that ultimately get to be in heaven. We can be one of them. All right, so the second thing I want to take a look at is some of the descriptions that we have of heaven. And again, there's not a lot when you compare it to the entirety of the Bible. I saw different percentages. It kind of depends on how you break it down. It really doesn't matter. It's just it's not something that's covered in massive amounts as we go through. And a lot of the descriptions we have of heaven are somewhat difficult to understand. It's kind of hard for us to fully grasp what they're talking about. Isaiah 55:9 says, "For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." It's kind of hard to describe something that you can't fully get your mind around. Two times this past week I've had people talk about, well, they went to the doctor, they had some tests, they've seen the results of the tests on the patient portal, they don't really know what they mean yet. They've got to talk to a nurse, they need to talk to a doctor, they need to talk to, they need to get it explained. And that's kind of how I see heaven. We've got some images of heaven, we have some imagery here that tells us what it's like, but we can't fully grasp it because of our lack of ability. I think about when our kids were little and when you get ready to go on a trip and trying to explain to them, we're going to be gone for 2 weeks, we're going to ride in the car for X number of hours, we're going to go at this hotel, and we're going to see this, and they're just, they didn't get it. Okay, they probably still didn't get it even after the trip, it's hard to sometimes explain something to somebody that doesn't really have all the information, hasn't seen everything, et cetera, et cetera. So because of this, the Bible uses a lot of imagery. Imagery is just a descriptive language, using figures, things like that, to kind of help paint a picture. And a lot of what we have in the Bible is this way. Now, I came across a term that's not a term I'd ever heard of before I was working on this talk. It's called enameled imagery. I guess this is a term in poetry. But it's this is what I found out. It's a literary technique that uses figurative language to describe a scene with visual appeal of something that is lacquered, jeweled, glassy, often emphasizing a rich, vibrant, delicate appearance. So the idea is showing us something that is very hard and permanent and bright and shiny compared to what we're used to here on Earth, which is, you know, change and decay. All the leaves, you know, leaves are pretty, but they're dying, right? That's why they're falling down. And the smell of fall is because of all the stuff decaying and rotting away. And that's what goes on, and it cycles through. But yet when we see all these images of heaven, we see jewels and shiny glass, permanent, very, very different than what we normally see. And so some of these examples, the first one I want to mention is in Exodus 24, and this is the passage that I asked Nancy to put in the bulletin. Exodus 24, 9 and 10, this is when Moses is you know, preparing, he's getting the Ten Commandments, and when I read through Exodus usually, I'm thinking of the Exodus. I'm thinking of the journey. I'm thinking of the Israelites. I'm thinking about how are they behaving. I'm thinking of the struggles that Moses had. And I don't know how many times I've read this passage and missed this amazing glimpse into heaven. Exodus 24, starting verse 9, "Then Moses went up, also Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel, and there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, and it was like the very heaven in its clarity." They get this glimpse into heaven and what it's like. And it's like a sapphire stone. It is thrown. They're somehow seeing God from underneath that. It's just this amazing